You know I be in the D in the town all day. I be in the D in the F E A. You know I be in the D in the town all day. I be in the D in the F E A.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I'm Tristan Caracino,
and we are joined once again by the Decider, our draft analyst Zach Whitman. Welcome back.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Wow, that was a sunnier outlook than I was expecting after Zach's tweets over the weekend.
You know, we all have to keep ourselves occupied during a quarantine, right? I mean, there's got to be something to keep us going. So I supplied a lot of people online with a lot of entertainment, which was ritualistically flogging me.
Sometimes unintentionally so in the case of third Pelton brother Danny Kelly. But you are back to help us break down the entirety of the Seahawks draft. We did a podcast on Thursday night after they surprised pretty much everyone by drafting Jordan Brooks in the first round of the NFL draft. But now we are here to talk about the other six rounds and some more surprises delivered by your Seattle Seahawks. And it'll be an interesting discussion.
Do we not want to talk about your favorite Oregon Duck, Jordan Brooks, anymore? I mean, besides the fact that he has a perfect Oregon Duck. I still can't get over that. I try to look at Jordan Brooks, and I still just think, you know, Oregon Duck. But yeah, let's get into it.
I mean, I feel like we've said our piece. I don't know if we've come up with anything new on Jordan Brooks, except that I was rerunning the PFF draft simulator, taking into account the actual first round. And let me tell you, the grid for Jordan Brooks was ruining the score for my mock draft on PFF.
Ouch.
They graded it a 39.2 with an average score of 60.
The only thing I will say I think in defense of the pick more than our takes the other night, were that when it seems like a lot of the reports that were written were based on his 2019 season, where he was really utilized as a spy and really close to line of scrimmage. In 2018, he did do some, like, defending the pass and getting deeper and everything. So the scouting reports said, like, he basically had never seen a pass before and wasn't familiar with, like, you know, post 1970s football. We're probably a little premature because he did have the background earlier in his career. So certainly not my favorite pick, but just in the interest of fairness, the scouting reports probably were shaded a little bit more toward the 2019 season.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I mean,
well, that's good to hear. I want to say something nice about every single one of these draft picks later, looking at basically if we can do two different podcasts here, if we can do a positive podcast and a negative podcast or a Zach Whitman on Twitter podcast first. But do you feel like overall with the draft in general, that was kind of a trend that we saw was players who may not have had the strongest 2019 seasons but may have had better previous seasons?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think what I see when I looked at it, and I think John Schneider said later, is that they were kind of tailoring the draft toward a season where there wouldn't be a significant off season, and so they were looking for players who maybe were more ready. Instinctually, I'm not sure that's actually a good idea. I think you'd probably have to look back at the 2011 draft, when they didn't have an off season, and kind of look and see, maybe there is a point I'm unaware of. But I think that was probably the most consistent theme I could see coming through.
That makes sense. I mean, the other thing we got into this, but it sort of got more confirmation over time, is the idea that the draft pick of Jordan Brooks really seems to indicate that the Seahawks are going to still play a lot of base this season. Pete Carroll definitely seemed to confirm that over time.
So is this the one thing positive and one thing negative?
Oh, no.
Let's get to the positive later. General thoughts.
We're unfiltered right now. So the second round, the Seahawks come in with pick 59, and they surprise us all by moving up instead of moving back in the draft, something they didn't do until later. And give you up pick 101 plus 59 for the 48th pick to draft Tennessee defensive end Darrell Taylor. this was a lot for them to give up. It valued it, as I noted on Twitter, going by the Chase Stewart draft value chart that kind of better reflects the value that draft picks actually provide than the traditional Jimmy Johnson chart that teams tend to go more by, although you do see a discount from that original Johnson chart in the trades we see now. By that, they basically valued this like the 27th pick in the draft, which is where they used Jordan Brooks and apparently decided on him over Daryl Taylor. You must have strongly considered him at 27 to make this trade up.
Yeah, notably, I think, I can't remember, maybe it was Lachlan Fora, but one of the more plugged-in people, I think, had Taylor as the Seahawks first-round pick. I think he was predicting a trade down to the Packers and taking him at 30, which I think is a sequence that very almost happened.
Yep.
On Thursday night. So it seems like the Seahawks felt like he was a first rounder and they traded up capital that valued him like that. Whether or not I think my biggest question there is, where did everyone else value him? And obviously that's something we'll never get to know, because we just don't, you can't test the null hype. You can't test the opposite, right? Cause it's already happened. But that, I guess that'd be my question, is he really valued by other people to a point, because there were no defensive ends to go between 48 and 59. And I think probably my most negative, my nadir over the weekend was at this trade up. Shiel Kapadia, former Seahawks beat writer, we're all familiar with Shiel's tremendous work. He has 7 rules of drafting that I think are really smart. And number one in that list is, don't fool yourself into thinking you are better at drafting than other teams. Mm-hmm. You are probably not. And then number 4, don't trade up unless you're taking a big swing at a franchise-changing quarterback. And between those two, I think that it's just the Seahawks very well may get a really good player in Daryl Taylor. And the actual pick itself, I think I have less issue with. You can nitpick it, and there are concerns, I think, about his age and where he would have gone maybe. But it's really, if you're too confident in your ability to evaluate and you're trading up because you feel like you can isolate the best player in a certain group, that's where I do get a little nervous, because I think history has shown that teams are not good at drafting over the long term. Even if you have a great run like the Seahawks 2010 to 2012, you're going to have some bad years. So I think that's probably the most negative I got. And it was almost more the trade up than the player ultimately.
Totally agree. Daryl Taylor as a player, I'm kind of excited about. But the people who are out there being like, look at Daryl Taylor, he's good, right? It's just, it's not understanding how you win at the draft. And like trading up for one individual player when we're talking about pick 48. Like the reality is Daryl Taylor might be good, but he's not that good if he's falling to pick 48. Right. Like this is not a like game changing defensive end in all likelihood. And it's also not a circumstance like Frank Clark, who had off the field issues that pushed him later back in the draft. This is, you're giving up draft capital, very valuable draft capital, to go up and get one individual player, when the opposite, which is maintaining your draft capital and getting multiple players, is the only real way to win at the draft. And I just look at it and I'm like, okay, like I'm excited about Daryl Taylor, but I also would have been excited about them drafting somebody like, like Bradley Anae, who got drafted in the 5th round. And like, are we that confident that Daryl Taylor is that much better of a defensive end prospect than somebody like that, or any of the other players who went before then? And that's the thing to me where it's like, you could have drafted both of these players. You could have drafted 2 tight ends by keeping those picks. You almost certainly could have drafted Daryl Taylor also with the initial pick. And it's like, just isolating it as we are excited about Daryl Taylor doesn't make sense as far as evaluating drafts. Because I feel like people, and it's, look, this is the business that people are in when they're evaluating drafts. You have to look at the players. But like, the reality is, drafts are very difficult to judge based upon the individual players themselves. They are much easier to judge based upon quantity of draft picks made. And that's where they went wrong with this pick, especially those picks that are in the first 4 rounds or so, where they have a high likelihood of making the team. The Seahawks got themselves one less of those players by making this trade.
Did they trade the 101 overall?
Correct.
Is that right? There will be players taken after the 101st pick that look better than Daryl Taylor.
Oh, for sure.
And so I know that's an obvious point, and it's not fair to judge them like on the field, right, after 101, because you don't get to pick retrospectively. But the NFL draft has a very, very flat talent curve, especially outside like the top quarterbacks. But even in the first round, it's more flat than people think. And that's what's reflected by like the Chase Stewart chart that you're referencing instead of the Jimmy Johnson chart. And so showing confidence that you can isolate that player in the second round, I think, is probably foolhardy. I don't know. I guess, do we want to talk about Gerald Taylor, the player at all?
Can I say my one positive thing about the trade-up, since I don't know if we're going to talk that later? Like, there is a pretty good track record when the Seahawks have traded up under John Schneider, a group that includes Tyler Lockett, DK Metcalf, and Jaron Reed. There's not really – I wouldn't say there's any huge misses in there. I guess Jesse Williams would be the biggest miss of this group. Obviously, jury very much still out on Cody Barton and John Ursua, but and even Quentin Jefferson, where he was drafted, very solid value. Michael Dixon is a rookie, looked like solid value, and also a reminder that they traded up to take Michael Dixon.
I know. That was pretty wild.
I think that's completely fair. The only thing I would say there just in hazard is that I think a trade up and maybe makes more sense when there's a run going at a position because you really can see it. And so with DK Metcalf, obviously that was kind of the end of a talent cliff and a bunch of receivers went between 64 and the 10 or 15 picks after that. Jaron Reed was in a really good defensive tackle class and a bunch of them went, I think he was in the Chris Jones class when Chris Jones went toward the end of the first. It was a really solid defensive tackle class. And that was, again, where they're kind of trading up to get on the back edge of that tier of talent. And Jaron Reed was throughout the draft process, you know, in the late first, even in many people's minds. And even Tyler Lockett, I guess that was the same range where like Jalen Strong and a bunch of receivers went early third, another talent, you know, cliff. And so I think that's probably tough is that, when you look at it retrospectively and you see no other defensive ends going between 48 and 59,
well, that means AJ Epenesa did go between those two, which is interesting because Epenesa came into the draft, you know, from the outside boards, much higher rated. Someone we were talking about the Seahawks taking at 27, where, you know, there was no talk whatsoever of them until that report that you mentioned that Danny retweeted, like on the eve of the draft that had them taking Daryl Taylor. But, you know, he was someone that we talked about. We'll get to Football Outsiders sacks here, but they have him in there as a third or fourth round pick, like was the expected draft value for him.
That's for Taylor.
Yeah.
Cool.
But there are things to like about him. Like, now let's get into him as a player.
Yeah, I mean, excellent name, can I just say. It's a very, 1998 pass rusher name, which I do enjoy. You know, he's a good athlete. I think a lot of the people that we like and follow on Twitter, such as, you know, we referenced Danny, Third Pelton brother Mina Kimes as well. We're really taken with him and we're really defending the player, if not the trade up necessarily, and excited about him. He played at Tennessee. He is a little on the older side. He's going to be over 23 when the next season starts. And he is pretty maxed out with his frame at, like, I think it was 260, 265. He weighed into the combine. It's not a lot of physical development yet. But that does mean he's coming in probably closer to the player he's going to be than a guy like Rasheem Green, who I believe is actually younger than Rasheem, or he's older than Rasheem Green, even still, 2 years after being drafted. It's a completely different deal, right? You're drafting a guy who, and I think they intentionally have targeted guys who are going to be ready given the lack of training camp potentially. And so I think the hope for him, even the positive side, is that this is a guy who is really productive in the SEC, had some really good games against good teams. I think Georgia was on that list. And he'll be able to step in and kind of be good right away for the Seahawks because obviously they want to be contending this year. And they're without Clowney, it could be a real hole in the pass rush. So I think there is, with a draft pick, you always want there to kind of be an easy path to making an impact in that first season, right? That's definitely, and that was one of the criticisms we had of the Brooks pick, was that it's tougher to see that because of how much else they have going on at the position, unless they go to playing a lot of linebackers. In this case, they need defensive end help. They drafted a defensive end who very well may be ready to help early, and that is a promising thing.
Do you think that there's the potential of basically that being like, and this is, I know this is like a galaxy brain take, but there's almost like a market inefficiency in drafting older players, because if you have a player who's able to give you production early on in their career, basically the window that you have with draft picks is 4 years or whatever on their rookie contracts, where you're going to get excess value from the contract. So if you're drafting older players who are going to give you value during that time period before they hit free agency, do you think there's a potential of sort of like a market inefficiency there?
I don't think there, if there is, I don't think it's big enough to offset the fact that its age just certainly isn't valued enough. The actual evaluations, when we look back at production, for the specific case of a defensive lineman, imagine that this guy is 22 years old last year. And he's playing against a 19-year-old tackle. There's a physical advantage there, right? Mm-hmm. The years extra he has. It's very difficult to then look at his tape and decouple that and say, I'm going to watch this player, but I'm going to take off 2 years of age like he's Rasheem Green and make the same evaluation. Maybe there is an advantage to having someone more ready, but it's not clear to me that older players necessarily are more ready all the time. I mean, we look at LJ Collier, right? That's kind of the classic case there, where it's a player who's more mature and comes in. But if you don't have the ability to develop any further, like Darrell Taylor kind of seems maxed out physically. If you think he's dominating at the college level because he is physically superior and he has no more ability to advance physically, there is a concern there, I think, because maybe he's maxed out his talent too and he doesn't have the ability. I'm not saying that's true, but I think that's kind of the case against the older player, is that maybe they can help you early, but they won't be able to ever get to that higher level because you're drafting a worse player relatively kind of at the same like draft spot. If you had the same production and an older player.
But I think that point about the value of their experience at the college level is an important one, because this is part of what we see at the NBA, you know, not that it's exactly analogous, but, you know, the idea that older players don't develop, that actually is not really true. You look at a lot of the players who have made the biggest jumps in the NBA, they've been guys who are 3 and 4 year college players, or, you know, like a Jimmy Butler, for example, who develops into an entirely different player in the NBA. But a lot of what it is people see them as safer picks, and they're actually not, because that 3 year age advantage that is the huge edge for you at the college level, well, all of a sudden, you're at a 5 year age disadvantage against most of the people you're facing in the pro game. So I think that is an important relevant point. You know, I don't know if I guess I'm supposed to save my optimism about Darrell Taylor for later?
No, let's just go. We're just going through it. Let's do it now.
So Football Outsiders sacks year projections, they have two different versions of the projections. One is an actual projection of how many sacks the player will have, I think, in like their first 4 seasons. And then that factors in your draft round. So that's only 6.5 sacks for Darrell Taylor, projecting him as a 3rd to 4th round pick. It would go up retroactively now that he was actually taken in the middle of the second. But if you look independent of that, they have a rating that's like basically based on your college stats, some of your combine data, where do you rate relative to other defensive ends in their database, much like, you know, Zach's 3 Sigma rating on his website. And his rating puts him in the 74th percentile among defensive ends and was 3rd best in this year's draft behind Chase Young, who everyone agreed was the best pass rusher in this year's draft by a wide margin. And then intriguingly, Curtis Weaver, who ended up dropping until I think the 4th or 5th round. He went very late in this one because of the concerns about his body, basically.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, one of the most important thing for edge players is athletic ability and testing, and then the sexier type stuff. And so when I look at edge players, I kind of look at those two things, right? What's the history of production and what's the athleticism? And that's not always true. I mean, there's guys like Danielle Hunter who weren't productive in college, but from all indications, he wasn't able to fully test the combine because of a shoulder injury, I think. I'm sorry, no, his was a leg stress fracture. The shoulder injury was our first round pick there. But he wasn't able to fully test, but all indications are he is a really super athlete. And that is the kind of guy who the Seahawks have taken at end before. I mean, Bruce Irvin was actually a little older even, and a really superior athlete. And he made a really big impact as a rookie, as a pass rusher, notably sacking Aaron Rodgers, 3 times in that first half. And something that still brings me joy. So if Darrell Taylor can even do a little bit of that, it might be well worth it.
Yeah. Okay. So the 3rd round with they start in with the 64th pick in the 2nd round, trade down to the top of the 3rd round, pick 69, picking up pick 144 or 148, I believe, was the extra pick they got that to fill in the missing fifth rounder in this class. Solid bit of value there. Not as much of an overpay to move up as they were on the other end of to go from 59 to 48. But there they end up taking LSU guard Damian Lewis.
Yeah, he was great in Homeland.
We just hope he isn't a double agent. really get the people going here, right? We've been waiting on an exciting pick for the entire draft. Got a linebacker, defensive end, a lot of people hadn't heard of. And then you got to go guard in the third round, baby. Here we go.
I don't know. I have to say, I didn't mind this pick at all. And I think we'll probably talk about it later, but the moves made after this also make the process more clear to explain the pick. At the time, it was kind of you had to project that out a bit and say, oh, does this mean certain things are going to happen that kind of make it more sense? It was tough because I think everyone watching the Seahawks, and especially with the roster as it was, you know, on Friday, thought that tackle was probably a bigger hole on the roster, because you have Dwayne Brown, who's 34 maybe, and then you have Brandon Shell, who they signed, and I think is the third tackle. Our friend Jamarco Jones, who had the notable performance versus Chandler Jones, his presumably his cousin, was not a good affair though when he actually played tackle last. So I think a lot of people saw tackle as being that need. But honestly, taking I think that one negative aside, Lewis seems like a really good player. And I think there's a shifting for me at least that happens when we go from the first and second round. We start getting into the third and fourth rounds. Early third is still where you can get a really good player. You really haven't tailed off fully yet, but it is getting into the range where I'm just mostly concerned about getting a good player. And I do worry less about positional value as you get further down the draft. And really, because if they can get any kind of productive player on a contract that's for four seasons with club control at a really good rate, that does produce a lot of value for the team. And even if roster moves hadn't happened today, you still would see that in a year, 2 years, 3 years, that having a guard pick, if he's good, is really important. So I'm not going to come on here and pretend that I am, you know, Tom Cable and can get out there and really nail the class and figure out every good offensive line and grind that tape. But his stats, like for PFF, the tracking stats are very, very good. I think he gave up something like 5 sacks in the last 2 years. With a lot of snaps there, played a ton, and doesn't appear to be in that Seahawks mold of like only a run blocker. And I think that would probably be the more concerning thing to me is if they drafted a guard, but it was a guy who doesn't know how to pass pro, that would seem like a big deal. But in this case, they seem like they've drafted a guy who kind of is a good guard. And sure, it's in the early third, but it's not in the second round. It's in the third. And so I stress less about it, even if I feel like, sure, it's not like the ideal position to take there. If he is a good player, then it's, you know, very worth it.
I mean, do we want to just get into talking about these subsequent moves on the offensive line? Since, I mean, it does seem like a domino that's set up here.
We'd have to assume, given their release today of DJ Fluker and Justin Britt, Damian Lewis has a very good chance of starting the season. And when we talk about that excess value, like, he's somebody who could be worth quite a bit on this rookie contract. And even then, like, when we look at the class overall, I would say if you had to basically weight each pick of, like, how much career value will they give to the Seahawks, I feel like Damian Lewis is the one who I'm most confident in getting the most career value out of anybody in this draft.
That's reasonable. I think that makes sense. Yeah, I mean, that's actually a fair point. I hadn't thought of it that in that way, but I don't think I can think of anyone else who'd be more likely than a guard who has an immediate chance to start.
So the one thing this seemed to signal that was actually the second domino to fall was the release of Justin Britt, because you wouldn't take another guard if you were thinking that B.J. Finney was going to play guard. That suggested he was going to play center, which now he presumably is with Britt's release. And then then also releasing DJ Fluker. So now the competition at guard, they brought back Mike Iupati. You know, it's probably a three-way competition, I would say, primarily between Phil Haynes, who, you know, they were excited about last season in the draft, Lewis and Iupati for those two spots, with also potentially Chance Warmack fitting into that as well.
Where do you put Posick also? I mean, there's just a lot of guys on the line, right? Like, Joey Hunt has a chance to start at center. Between Hunt and Posick, I feel like there's quite a bit of depth on the inside of the line. On the outside of the line, where notably they didn't draft a tackle, that's the one, like you mentioned, Zach, where there are definitely some veterans that they brought in, but there's no proven depth necessarily there, and there's really not a lot of young talent there either.
Yeah, the last time Damian Lewis joined a group this big, it was easy company. Am I right?
He'll be here all night, folks.
See, as a charter member of the Damian Lewis fan club, I have to get in there. Billions, I think, starting soon. But yeah, I think, I mean, that's just the obvious concern, right? Is who do they have at tackle if Dwayne Brown, and I'm actually pretty high on the Brandon Shell signing. I think that's actually a really good process to get someone. We were thinking about, you know, many people were talking about paying a Fetty in the 12 or 15 million range or something, and they have a guy, you know, for a fraction of that who kind of seemed like had similar performance being drafted in the fifth round of the same draft that Fetty was. So I'm actually pretty optimistic about the two tackles that we have starting. It's what is the depth behind that? And then looking at Jones, the Houston tackle, Josh Jones fell just behind us and then got taken by the Cardinals in a classic case of like let a team letting the draft fall to them instead of reaching ahead of the draft, you know, and picking their guys, just taking it there. So I think that was probably the toughest part. But I mean, what do we do, I guess, if Brown or Shell get hurt? That's the really scary thing to me.
Cliff Kingsbury was not rushing anything in that draft. He was living easy in Arizona.
Who needed to? PFF had Joshua Jones 12th on their board, so he spent a long time as their best available player, almost as long as Huskies spent as Mel Kiper's best available
12th
player.
12th overall? Or is the 12th tackle?
12th overall.
Wow!
They loved them some Joshua Jones, who is a bit older. He's age 23, so is his Damian Lewis, for that matter. Okay, let's move ahead to the fourth round. With the 133rd pick, the Seahawks decide to add another long-haired tight end to Techno Thursday with Stanford's Colby Parkinson.
I think my only memory, probably similar to you guys, I did remember him playing against the Huskies as one of their very tall, long-haired tight ends that I hated. So that... As an immediate take, I definitely had a visceral kind of, you know, hatred inside, as one does. It's an interesting pick because it's one of these ones where everyone says, well, he's a really great athlete, and he's like this tight end who's going to actually be a receiver. So he didn't test well at all, and that's definitely a red flag. If you're trying to make a case as an athlete, you should test well as an athlete. Not that every player has to be a good athlete, but if your thing is like high upside, athletic, kind of be really, you know, in that vein, that is definitely a little concerning. He is a contested catch type guy, you know, as obviously as we saw at Stanford at the high touchdown rates. I do wonder to some extent if they use him kind of like they used DK Metcalf at the first part of last season, when Metcalf would have like the next gen stats. The route trees that were him like moving a total of like 20 yards round trip every single snap from the exact same position on the left of the formation there. I wonder, I guess, if that's the usage or if they're envisioning him more doing like, you know, middle of the field type stuff, almost more like we saw Sidney Rice maybe many years ago. But this pick does have some red flags to me. Not, you know, a tremendously productive college player. Going back to Sheil Kapadia in terms of his rules, don't overrate your coaching staff's ability to dramatically change who a player was in college. And if drafting a receiver, make sure he was productive in college. Those two things definitely are you have to weigh those in and say, okay, there's a lot of potential there, but one, you know, what was his draft stock before the draft? Is he a fourth rounder? Maybe, maybe not. Is the positional value there? Sure, you know, a target for Russ. But wouldn't you, I guess the answer is I would have liked to see them go after one of the many receivers in a very strong receiver class if they're focusing on that. Someone like Isaiah Hodgins at Oregon State, who went a few rounds later, who was incredibly productive and is like a 6'3 guy, who could definitely do a lot of really good things in that same vein, but has the history of production to go with it. So I'm not super negative on it, but I look at it and I think, you know, it's very, very, very Seahawks in the middle rounds. And I think they've done this in the fourth round specifically, it feels like a fair bit, where they isolate something a player does, a way that player wins, and then they project that into a role on their team, a very narrow, specific role. But when it comes to actually getting a player to make the roster, it can be somewhat difficult when they have a very, very specific role. If it takes them any time to kind of step into that and be productive at that, I think that's why we've maybe seen them with guys like Chris Harper in the past or Chris Durham, who stuck around for a year. They definitely have done things, you know, not too far off from this maybe. I know this is a different player, but I do get those kind of warning bells still.
Those are maybe arguments for them not drafting a wide receiver in the fourth round. Also, just a really packed position group with players who've played in the NFL, like, and also having some young talent there, too. But, I mean, one of these players is going to have to go between Disley, Hollister, Greg Olsen, Colby Parkinson, or Luke Wilson. And, look, I'm not saying that there's incredible talent there, but these are NFL players, and it just doesn't feel like if there was almost any position of need, I'm not sure if tight end was it, and there had to be better players out there than Colby Parkinson with this pick if you're just taking the best player available.
I mean, I would say two of those guys have to go in all likelihood, and if I'm Jacob Hollister, I'm not feeling very good about my chances of making the roster at
just
all right
a
now, which...
lot of white guys.
It's, yeah, a lot of long-haired white guys too. I would say more excited about, even though Parkinson had more catches last year, is a junior, and he is somewhat younger in early entry into this. I felt better about his production as a sophomore when KJ Costello was at quarterback and Stanford was good offensively as compared to last season. And that's where he had 7 touchdowns in 13 games, just 1 touchdown last season. I mean, you mentioned Metcalf. To me, I'm thinking, are the Seahawks going to want to bring out a lot of what they finally, after like 3 years, got to with Jimmy Graham in the red zone, that kind of usage with Parkinson, and then hopefully not take it until immediately before he goes and signs with Green Bay?
If he can do that, it's an awesome pick, right? Having a red zone weapon who can actually do that. And I think, like, it's worth taking shots at it, certainly. So this is not a pick I'm going to say is like the worst thing ever or whatever. I'm not super excited about it, but all these picks are, you know, lottery tickets to some extent. And that would be an incredibly valuable thing, is if he could be that kind of red zone talent like Graham was.
So the Seahawks took a really long time before they took a running back. A lot of the guys they seemed to be interested in went early. There was like a bit of a run on running backs in the second round, including A.J. Dillon, who was someone they were thinking about, okay, maybe they draft him, you know, in the fourth round or somewhere in that range. And he goes in the second round to Green Bay, and one of the more shocking picks after Green Bay's first round pick.
Yes.
The PFF broadcast after A.J. Dillon went in the second round, I mean, they had a field day, almost like Ben Baldwin did in his on his timeline. But the Seahawks then finally at the 144th pick do go for a running back, taking DJ Dallas, who backed up Travis Homer his first 2 years at the U before playing a slightly larger role last season, splitting time.
Yeah, so they were going to take a running back. So for me, If I were in control of an NFL team, would I take a running back? I would just get one at undrafted free agency. But I'm kind of judging this as I knew they were going to take one, so I was actually thrilled they waited until the fourth round. It's hard to know if they were saved by other teams, you know, going early on other guys, like you said, like Dillon, and there was a whole run, like you said. But for me, basically knowing they're going to take one, the only thing I really cared about when I heard the name was to Google and see if this is a guy who has pass game value. In addition to everything else, you know, what kind of type is he? And he does appear to be more in that that vein where he talks about how he really loves pass protection and pass blocking. He's very involved in the pass game. He has return experience. And so, you know, knowing that it's not the optimal use of a pick because of the position, you know, it's fine. Running backs, trying to evaluate running backs off of their even their college production is really tough, right? There's guys like Chris Carson who come in like a house on fire when he didn't do a ton of Oklahoma State. So the projection there, and that's part of the reason we say don't draft them, is because the projection is very difficult, and it's pretty hard to figure out which ones are going to be really productive, and largely because it's so much a function of what scheme you were in college and what scheme you're going to be in the NFL and what your lines look like, right? But I have to say, my immediate take was basically, can this guy pass block, and can he, you know, be a safety valve? And it seems like, you know, there he can do that, so feeling decent about it.
I mean, the one concern I had is, like, you know, I think a lot of the logic behind why the Seahawks needed to draft a running back was, well, when both Chris Carson and Rashad Penny got hurt last year, the position group was too weak at that point. And this, the key player in that, besides Marshawn Lynch, obviously, coming out of retirement, was Travis Homer, who was playing ahead of DJ Dallas at Miami. So if you feel like that's going to solve things, I'm not sold there. But I agree with you, like, yeah, the ability in the pass game. And then also I think something that's going to be really important for his chances of being on the active roster early on is the fact that he returned kicks and punts as a sophomore before presumably becoming too important to do that last season, averaged 17.4 yards per punt return and did have a touchdown in that role. So I would not be surprised to see him returning punts next season, if there's a season.
It is kind of incredible, though, when you compare his stats to, like, Travis Homer's in their last season. Travis Homer is 164 carries for 985 yards at 6 yards per clip in his senior year, 19 receptions for 186 yards. And you look at DJ Dallas at exactly 6 yards per rush as a junior, and then 14 catches for 140 yards. Like, they were eerily identical numbers, and Travis Homer just got more work, where you just have to ask yourself the question, like, is DJ Dallas actually going to make this team ahead of Travis Homer? Or are they going to be keeping this many running backs on the roster? I mean, the thing that they highlighted on the ESPN draft itself was the pass blocking, though. So it could be the type of thing where it's like, maybe Travis Homer is a better running back than DJ Dallas is, but this one skill that DJ Dallas provides might actually be more valuable as your if you're putting so much, have put so much emphasis on your starting two running backs already, maybe having a third running back that's not necessarily supposed to come in and be able to play behind them, but provide one unique skill, then, and I don't think that's worth a fourth round pick or whatever, but fuck it. Maybe that's where it exists.
If there is a season and the season starts in September, I would guess that one of the other two guys will be on the PUP list to start the season.
That's
knowing nothing. So it seems like making the roster actually won't be too difficult as a running back on the 2020 Seahawks.
The other thing was, you were talking about that run on running backs. This is just a theory where it's like, I feel like front offices have taken enough shit for drafting running backs early that they're just like, okay, we can't draft running backs early. We know everybody is going to roast us for it. So we're just going to wait until the second round. It's like they all wanted to draft running backs in the first round, but they're like, all right, now's the time, boys. It's like the floodgates opened and they were like, we can get our running backs now. All these running backs that the press, who's viewing it from the position of the press, are probably even a little bit more statistically inclined somehow, is looking at it where they're like, A.J. Dillon's a fifth-round running back. They don't think like NFL front offices. And NFL front offices see A.J. Dillon, and they see a first-round pick who you have to take in the second round.
So basically, this is like when I would wait at GameStop for the game my mom wouldn't let me get because it was too expensive. I'd wait at GameStop for it to be like that first time it was used. It comes in like a month later for, you know, 70% of the price, then you're getting it because then it's okay.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I was going to go, it's like hearts when someone has to play a heart for you to be able to play them. Like someone has to start it. And the Chiefs actually did that by taking Edwards-Helaire with the last pick of the first round. No one?
They opened
very,
up the
very relatable. Very relatable.
Okay, so just four picks later, but across into the fifth round, the Seahawks go back to the edge and take Syracuse edge rusher. He played much like Taylor played outside linebacker in a 3-4 defense in college, but projects as a defensive end in the NFL. Elton Robinson.
So this is my favorite pick of the draft. I thought this was pretty smart. Elton Robinson, not overaged, and once you get to the fifth round, there's not that many young guys left in general. He played at Syracuse. He's not even 22 years old yet. Reasonably productive, good athlete. And the fifth round is a really good place to, I mean, there's just a lot of defensive linemen who get taken in the fifth round. There are defensive linemen who thrive on day three at a greater proportion than some other positions. So in general, if I were trying to optimize things, I probably would take some shots on these guys because evaluating defensive linemen is really hard. And you know, it's a crapshoot with some of these guys. So with this, I mean, you're getting a guy who reasonably athletic, reasonably young, has a shot at a position of need, at a premium position. It kind of satisfies all those criteria to me. The red flag on him is that he had a really poor three cone at 7.32 seconds. Generally good pass rushers really tend to have a really, really good agility drills. He did have a better shuttle time, and all the agility drills at the combine this year are pretty weird because they had the players doing them really late at night, to fit the primetime schedule that, the TV network, demanded. So it is tough, but you look at it and think in a different year with a pro day, it may have come out a lot different for him and it may have looked better. It's also making an excuse, but it's the fifth round, right? So we don't know in the fifth round. You're just looking for a lottery ticket on a player who looks reasonably kind of to fit the right criteria. I think that's true for Robinson. He's a guy who might have a decent chance of making the roster. And it's not like the Seahawks haven't had recent success with, you know, linemen in the fifth round. Quinton Jefferson, maybe 4 years ago now, I guess, because he signed the contract, was taken there. It is a place where you might be able to find kind of spot, you know, edge players, interior players at a decent rate. That's not to say there's any kind of good chance he's there, but, you know, certainly there's going to be a few players from the fifth round every year that are useful.
I mentioned earlier that Football Outsiders' sack CR rating that doesn't take into account the round in which you're drafted. He was ninth in that, so a pretty solid score, and 7 of the 8 players ahead of him had already been drafted, only the aforementioned Curtis Weaver, who did, in fact, go later in the fifth round.
Yeah, if you were drafting according to kind of like, you know, the more analytical, letting the draft fall to you, I think he's a name that you would have picked there. So it definitely makes a lot of sense. And I think the process behind it, he's probably not the best player the Seahawks drafted, but I think the process was very solid on this.
There we go.
You finally got there.
Pick 148.
So all of these wide receivers go off the board in is widely considered the deepest receiver class ever. You know, people have 18 receivers in their top 100. I don't think quite that many guys went there. The Seahawks don't draft one until the sixth round and then take Freddie Swain, wide receiver, Florida.
This guy's not making the roster.
You're already calling it.
Wow. I struggle with this one because it's just I got in a lot of trouble on Twitter for tweeting after this because this one felt like personally trolling me, which obviously it wasn't, but it definitely felt that way because Isaiah Hodgins was a really good player at Oregon State, very productive, a player I was quite interested in, and he went at the 207th selection. And at that point, I basically declared in a group chat with some of my friends, well, okay, they don't need to take a receiver anymore. All the receivers are gone. And then about 15 minutes later, the Seahawks with the 214th selection took Freddie Swain. Freddie Swain was not a productive receiver at Florida. He had a higher touchdown rate than like yardage rate as a proportion of his team, but he still had 3 really unproductive years and then 1 just unproductive year at Florida. And he had a bad quarterback and everything, but making excuses for receiver, I think he was the 30th or so receiver taken. There is not a lot of chance that he's going to be a good player to me, unproductive. I don't know. This is one where it feels like the Seahawks are drafting very traitsy, and that's fine. And maybe he runs those beautiful routes and everything, but just like there's such a small track record of guys who are that unproductive throughout their college careers being good NFL receivers, that it's hard just watching basically kind of the end of a very good receiver class, where every receiver that was taken, there was some draft nick who was, you know, quote tweeting and saying, love this guy's performance against, you know, whatever Polytechnic, love this guy's performance against State. You get to Isaiah Hodgins. Oh, you know, he had some great days in the Pac-12. And then I swear Freddie Swain is there, and everyone goes, well, that's the end of the receivers, because the Seahawks got kind of that first guy who's off there. So I don't know. This does not feel like he's going to be making the roster to me.
I mean, it's the sixth round, but I will say, if he does make the roster, I think the way that he's going to make it, by the way, he did have 6 catches for 146 yards last year against Auburn, so I guess that would be his one game. That was his only game with triple-digit receiving yards in his career. If he makes the roster, it is going to be as a punt returner. He also did that as a junior, averaged 10.2 yards per return, returned 22 punts, so I think that's his best shot at making the roster.
Right, but by the 2020 draft unified theory, we already decided DJ Dallas is the punt returner.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be an intense competition. So we thought that was the end of the Seahawks draft. This, I did not like the process on. They did not have any more picks after 214, but then trade a 2021 sixth round pick to get the fourth from the final pick in the seventh round. Which, like, you've got to be really confident that someone else is going to take this guy, and you're not going to be able to sign him as an undrafted free agent. Or he must have told you he's not going to sign as an undrafted free agent. I'm not sure of the process there, but I don't like it. To take Stephon Sullivan, a wide receiver / tight end from LSU, played his first 3 years as a wide receiver before moving primarily to tight end as a senior and catching 12 passes as a senior on this amazing LSU offense. Started 2 games, most productive as a junior with 23 catches for 363 yards and 2 touchdowns. But it became clear that Pete Carroll, this was Pete's guy, much like Chris Carson was his guy a few years ago. This was Pete's guy who he had told the Seahawks that the Seahawks were going to go get him, and they had to give up a 21 sixth round pick to do it.
It's not ideal. I've been advised by my attorney, my legal representation, not to get too far into this, but I don't know. It's bad process, right? And it's frustrating because it seems like if you were going to do this, you wouldn't take a guy who does the seemingly would be in direct competition for a roster spot with the guy that you also took in the fourth round.
And dude's only attribute is the same as his. He's also really tall.
He's also tall and runs in a straight line in a reason. But did you see the part about Orgeron? This was like a Pete Orgeron thing.
Oh, no, I didn't see that. That makes sense.
Yeah, so it almost felt like to me this was also Pete, like, you know, taking Orgeron's guy too and getting him drafted. And they're going to give him probably every chance to succeed, I think, because Orgeron basically, it seemed like they're saying, like, this is a great guy. You know, you got to give him a chance and everything. So it does
that feel, wasn't how he was going to say it. He was saying it, but none of us is going to attempt an Ed Orgeron impersonation.
You got to tell people to cough like Ed Orgeron. No, I don't know. Like, I will say that if they had just taken him with the 251st pick, I would have been fine with it just because it seems like a cool human interest story and that'll at least keep us occupied during training camp. But trading a future sixth for that human interest story seems a little steep.
Especially, like, this to me, if you're a good team, you should not be trading any future picks for next year because there's a decent chance that there's no season and we're just randomizing the draft for 21. Like, if you're a bad team, this actually is the time to trade your future picks because other teams might value them more than they should. But if you're a good team, not the time to trade future picks.
So you think next year's draft gets randomized?
I mean, you wouldn't give the worst teams the best picks 2 years in a row based on that, I don't think.
Do you randomize per round, or do you just randomize an order and then run it through that round?
I don't know. I mean, there's no precedent for this.
They should do it like the NFL picks leagues, where like they randomly give everyone a number of picks that all have the same value.
Maybe it's a snake draft.
Who knows what they might do in 21?
Like, imagine if they did it though, like with the picks league, where like the team that gets the first pick doesn't get to go again until like the 113th pick because it has to work out that all the value is the same and it's on the Jimmy Jones thing. So actually, you want to get the latest pick possible.
I mean, if I needed Trevor Lawrence, I would be okay with that.
Yeah.
Well, at wide receiver, I just don't know, looking at this wide receiver class, like, I honestly don't get what the logic is here. And I know that once you get this far down in the draft, you shouldn't necessarily be drafting for position, but it just really chaps my ass that the Seahawks every year seem to not get what the hot position is that year, right? Like, in the year that there's all these great tight ends, they don't draft George Kittle. Instead, they draft a tight end the year later. And in the year where there's all these good wide receivers, they're like, no, we're sitting this year out on wide receivers. When you look at it and it's like, are there five wide receivers that you feel confident can make this roster? Right? Like, you're trying to help out Russell Wilson here by drafting a fuckload of tight ends. It just doesn't make any sense process-wise. And like, look, maybe we're okay with some of these picks, and like Damian Lewis seems like he was a good pick, but you also gave up a pick to move up and get one defensive end when you could have just kept that fucking pick and drafted both a defensive end and a wide receiver, right? Where it's like, they came out of this obviously no better at wide receiver, no more confident in that group, and you look around the league, there aren't any other wide receivers out there. There's no place that they're going to be able to fill this need at any point. And then you're like, well, I guess John Ursua is definitely making the roster. Like, Philip Dorsett is now maybe the number three receiver. Like,
he's definitely the number three receiver.
I'm actually fine with that generally.
But it gets pretty bleak at receiver pretty fast. And adding any sort of young talent would have made a lot of sense in the year that all the good receivers were in the draft. And
how are they going to keep five tight ends and six running backs if they keep that many wide receivers? Like,
they managed to trim down from their 19 offensive linemen.
This is just the Drill Candles tweet, right? But
it really is. It really is.
I mean, there was a particularly negative tweet that I thought was very good over the weekend that I don't need to quote exactly, but Nathan Ernst, who does stuff at Hawk Blogger, basically referenced John Schneider avoiding the strength of the class being really annoying. And it is very frustrating, and it's not something they always done. I mean, they went after the defensive tackle class several years ago, as we remember.
It's the defensive tackle class, so they got pretty excited about that.
Right. But it's frustrating to me because I think the best example of this is tight ends, right? In 2016, they took a tight end in the third round, Nick Manette. 2017 was an extremely good tight end class. Many of us liked many of the tight ends. Some of us liked George Kittle a lot. And the Seahawks decided not to take a tight end in 2015 or 2017. They then took a tight end in 2018 in the fourth round with Will Dissly, and then took another tight end this year in the fourth round. So they are more than happy to take mid-round picks on tight ends. But certainly not in the year where there are a bunch of really good prospects at tight end. So I think that is definitely frustrating. And when it comes to getting value out of the draft, going out of a position where there's a bunch of really good players and some of those by necessity will drop, is a really good way of doing that. And it's frustrating to watch it because even into the fourth and fifth rounds, if they hadn't traded the 101st pick, there would have been a good receiver there. There'll be a player who has a good NFL career at receiver after the 101st pick. And
we're circling that 101st pick.
It is going to be annoying. It's going to be annoying, right?
Better players after. I mean, we still, like, looking back on the Kittle thing, it, like, hurts physically knowing that we wanted Kittle going into the draft, and not only did you not take him, and partially because they had taken a tight end before then, but that he went to the fucking 49ers, like, it's so frustrating to look at how, and it feels like we're almost paying a price because of how good the Seahawks have always basically ignored draft boards, all right, or whatever. Like, they have their own process for evaluating players, and they do not care how the rest of the league evaluates players. And we're being punished now because that strategy worked 8 years ago, right? Like, they haven't changed that strategy. And really, like, there's obviously good players who come out of every draft for basically every team. but having any sort of like very solid, consistent draft, it's been about, it was 7 years with evidence since that's happened. And it feels like they're just sticking with that point because they managed to lock into Russell Wilson 8 years ago.
I mean, the 2015 draft was pretty successful.
Cool.
Yeah, and it also wasn't just Russell Wilson. It was also that they drafted Richard Sherman in the fifth round and Cam Chancellor in the fifth round.
Those players aren't on the team anymore. The only reason that these people still have their jobs is because of Russell Wilson.
That's the primary reason.
I feel bad about this draft from the perspective of Russell Wilson as the most important person in the franchise, just being like, give him some fucking help here, right? And potentially a defense.
Amazing to look at this from Russell Wilson's perspective and think, oh good, what did my team do for me during this draft? Well, they cut my starting guard and replaced him, which is good. And then they drafted Travis Homer's backup, a receiver at Florida who had 100-yard receiving game in his career, and then two tight ends who are actually slot receivers who will be expecting you to throw to now. it's not the most exciting list, maybe, like a guard, two tight ends. It's kind of like the, I don't know, it's a weird amalgamation of stuff. There's no name brand there. There's nothing like truly exciting to me. And I think that's fine. Like a draft doesn't have to be exciting. A draft can be, you know, it can be boring positions and it doesn't have to be a receiver every year. And they're not going to draft two receivers in every class, but it is tough when you look at it in sum and say the offensive players they added were a guard, kind of a third down type running back. It seems like that's how they have him projected. Two tight ends who weren't overly productive in college, although Parkinson had more success than Sullivan, and a receiver who really has, I don't know, who might be a punt returner is our justification for the pick. So that's it. That is not a lot of offensive talent to add.
There's good news, though. They added a receiver who had 600-yard receiving games in college. And that receiver's name is Aaron Fuller.
The 2015 draft, like, yes, Frank Clark and Tyler Lockett were both good picks, and then there's basically nobody else who made the team.
But those two by themselves are enough for a good draft.
Wow, you're just going to disrespect Zach and Christian Sokol like that? Come on, man.
Hoping that would go unnoticed.
I like that one of the other undrafted receivers they signed, Seth Dawkins from Louisville, also had 1,510 career receiving yards and never more than 642 in a season. They are really fading production in college.
Excellent. Just excellent.
Aaron Fuller's awesome, though. Come on. Like
I can't complain.
Of the undrafted free agent class, I mean... Of the just the Huskies who are undrafted free agents, like if there was one that they were going to go out and get, it's Aaron Fuller to me, who feels like he's just in this lineage of it goes curse to Kason Williams, right to Aaron Fuller, of productive Huskies who just get ignored by the NFL and are sitting out there in their hometown ready to be scooped up by the Seahawks and then get cut on the last day of training camp.
Maybe if they hadn't drafted so many tight ends, it could have been Hunter Bryant could have been the guy you would have prioritized out of right up free agents.
Skill-wise, Hunter Bryant is at least a fourth-round pick.
I mean, there has to be a pretty bad medical reason, right?
But at some point in like the seventh round, who cares? These guys aren't going to make your roster anyway, so get the guy who's actually talented and has done good things on the field.
They'd already drafted two tight ends.
They could have not done that.
I mean, the like people were talking about Hunter Bryant as having an Evan Engram comp, right? Like, what is the best case scenario for Colby Parkinson?
I mean, I think we covered it earlier as being like what we used Jimmy Graham for a few years ago. Right. But I think the frustration there is, for me, teams are very wrapped around the axle with their own kind of ability to get to guys and their medicals and everything. And I do think that if this was a normal year with pro day circuit and teams getting to evaluate him, there probably would be some teams who actually looked at him and decided they could draft him. And him not being drafted is largely a you know, just not having the ability to do tests and everything. And I just, you know, as someone who's watched Hunter Bryant and wishes for his success, that is kind of a bummer.
Do we want to talk UW now or go into the other Seahawks undrafted free agent of note?
Let's talk Anthony Gordon first.
All right, so the other side of the state, Wazoo quarterback Anthony Gordon lands with the Huskies, is an undrafted free agent in a situation where right now there seems to be a, you know, we'll see what happens if they re-sign Geno Smith, but right now a pretty clear path to backing up Russell Wilson.
I have a question. Do we think Pete has watched Anthony Gordon before?
Yeah, he definitely would have watched some college games.
Definitely has watched Anthony Gordon.
Because Pete does not like the kind of football that... Like, I'm very excited about the Anthony Gordon thing, but I'm also very excited about the prospect of watching Pete Carroll watch Anthony Gordon. Like, that would just be phenomenal. Can you imagine, like, he spent how many years telling that one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL not to take any risks and whatever? And all of a sudden, he has Anthony Gordon just, like, being basically just full Gordo in a Pete Carroll offense and slinging it around. I mean, it's like a magical, like, mental image for me.
I mean, think about it this from BJ Daniels' perspective. BJ Daniels tweeted at Seahawks eyes emoji, and I'm curious whether that's just him hoping or that means something. Dragons to Seahawks, here we go. Gordon going from playing for Mike Leach to Pete Carroll is quite a shift in offensive philosophy.
Yeah, I don't know. To me, it feels a little bit like when I was a kid and I would trick my mom into renting a movie that I shouldn't have been able to watch. Like, I feel like John Schneider, like, got a good backup quarterback and undrafted free agency potential, and that's really exciting. But, like, Pete Carroll is going to need, like, to be sedated if Anthony Gordon actually plays for us in a real football game.
I mean, the Gordon numbers are incredible. Was he that much worse than Minshew was? Are his numbers that far off from Gardner Minshew?
They're a bit down from Minshew's, but I wouldn't say they're that far off. I mean, more Minshew, the fact that he became an NFL starter as quickly as he did was pretty surprising.
Fuck it. Anthony Gordon, backup quarterback. Let's go.
All right, so let's talk about the other UW, the handful of other UW draftees in this class. No Huskies drafted in the first four rounds? Wait, where did Eason go?
Yeah,
in the first three rounds. So Jacob Eason, just after they highlighted him going into the second round of the draft, a lot of thinking that the Colts might trade when they traded up, which was actually to get Jonathan Taylor Thomas, that it was going to be for him. And then finally they wait and they wait, and they finally draft him in the fourth round, a stunning fall for someone who, when he declared, we thought for certain would be a day two pick at worst.
Did we lose Zach?
Sorry, I just...
Stunned.
I don't know. I don't think Jacob Eason's a very good quarterback.
Oh, no.
So I am not, I guess, like, not as stunned. I think him and Philip Rivers in the same place is a great idea, and I would watch that Hard Knocks 10 out of 10 times. But I personally am not that high on Eason, because I've said before,
you watched him play football.
I don't think he's, like, great at quarterbacking. I think he has pretty arm, and, like, I would love to, like, sit in an empty stadium and watch him, like, throw. He has an amazing arm, and it's very, very fun. But I don't think he's a good quarterback necessarily. He is going to have, I predict in his career, like, three amazing red zone moments where the camera pans and, like, you turn around and you see the ball, like, lofting in the air going, like 60 yard type. Like, I think he'll have, like, a few great moments is what I'm hoping for from him. But I definitely
we're talking like think week three in the preseason, week four.
Yeah. that he will have some good preseason highlights. That's right.
I mean, the man puts together a highlight package. Like, the highlight package they played on ESPN after he got drafted, I was like, wow, take him in the first round.
He's better than Trevor Lawrence, yeah.
We watched all the other plays, too.
On its own. I mean, we were ready to draft him with the top pick in the draft after that BYU game.
I forgot how good that TD was when he was going to his left.
Yeah.
And he hit, was it Ahmed in the back of the end zone?
Newton. It was Newton.
Oh, it was Newton. That's right. Yeah, that was amazing. God,
I don't even think that was his best throw. I mean, obviously, it was, like, impressive because he's
drifting to his
left. Yeah, the one he sticks in there to pull.
The seam throw was also ridiculous.
Oh, my God. I mean, Jacob Eason obviously is capable of very high-level football, but this is sort of like, this is my complaint with the quote-unquote tape grinders as well, where it's like, if you're really looking at just a snippet of what a player can do, like, if you're looking on tape, you can always find good plays from basically every player, right? Like, you're not going to be grinding tape on all whatever hundreds of snaps that player played the entire season. And I think Eason as a quarterback might have gotten indicted for this more than somebody at a different position does, where it's like the negative stood out a little bit more because you are seeing the quarterback on basically every single play. But if all you ever saw of Jacob Eason was like this 10 great throws, you'd be like, fucking love this guy, right? Because Jordan Brooks, you're ignoring on every other play that he doesn't do something good. So, like, Eason is very capable of highlight plays. The problem was his actual ability to play football. It's like in NCAA football, RIP, NCAA football 14, where Jacob Eason has, like, excellent throwing power, pretty good accuracy, and, like, a 32 awareness. Right? Like, it's like he just could not put it together as a player. I'm physically, he's really not an NFL quarterback at this point with his ability to evade pressure. And also it really shows how the NFL is changing what they're looking for in quarterbacks. You know, we joked the entire season about how like somebody was going to fall in love with this tall white quarterback with a big arm, and they did. And that team was the Chargers. Did they draft Justin Herbert?
They did.
Herbert still was able to go, but seeing somebody like Jalen Hurts get drafted in the second round and players and Jacob Eason not get drafted in the second round, or Jordan Love, like anybody you can sort of remotely compare to Mahomes, you're like, that's our guy. I think the era of the tall, white, unathletic quarterback might, and I'm going to knock on wood when I say this, at least for one season, be fading a little bit in the NFL. Because
Herbert's deceptively athletic, first off. But I disagree with you. I think this is a case where Eason, like, the intel, clearly, from everything we heard, was not good. It didn't sound like his meetings with teams at the combine went well. It sounded like this was not a repudiation of tall quarterbacks. This was a repudiation of Jacob Eason individually.
He needed to get interview training from Trey Adams.
Yeah. which did not help Trey Adams, sadly. I'm sure his medicals.
Watching that and just thinking about somebody who works with artists who do interviews, where it's just like, dude, this is such a bad answer for any interview ever.
Okay, so the only other Huskies player who gets drafted with the 160th pick, center Nick Harris, going to Cleveland.
Well, as I discussed, I'm a big Nick Harris fan, so this is great. I legitimately think it's a awesome landing spot. He has a great, you know, chance to make the roster as being a fifth round pick. You know, a fair number of those guys make it. So I was like really excited. I thought, you know, he would be the one, I guess, to go undrafted before Bryant and Ahmed. But yeah, no, it's awesome for Nick Harris.
It was like with the Huskies players preseason, you could have just taken darts and thrown them about who was going to get drafted and who wasn't. I mean, I think we all knew Eason was going to get drafted. But beyond that, like Nick Harris being drafted, Trey Adams not, Hunter Bryant not being drafted, pretty shocking.
I mean, I was thinking back to the Tasteful Profanity live show where one of the questions that we discussed with Mike and John was who will be the first UW player drafted? And you were very confident that it was going to be Jacob Eason. I was already an Eason skeptic at that point. So when he keeps dropping, I'm like, I'm going to be able to take a victory on this lap on this if someone else goes higher. But the people I said were Trey Adams and Hunter Bryant, and they didn't get taken at all. So yeah,
there's your victory lap. Well, look, I forgot that happened, but now I'm going to take a victory lap.
There you go. There you
go. So, I also said that the Huskies were going to go undefeated.
I was very confident they were going to beat Oregon. I knew they were listening to Stanford. Times.
They did beat Oregon, right?
At what
this
point?
Year?
Yeah, they won. The game ended middle fourth quarter.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Sorry, I've repressed through therapy a lot of things that happened this year. So
there will never be a better moment than like Herbert getting sacked or like throwing the. This was midway through the third quarter, and like getting sacked or throwing the ball away or something, or like a terrible incompletion and being pretty drunk still and yelling, "Teams are tanking for you, Herbert." and then them, of course, coming back and beating us. But that one moment, I was like, wow, it's all really happening. Then the season pretty much ended from that point forward.
Well, yeah, a lot of Utah guys got drafted. Let me tell you, a lot of their highlights were against UW this past year. So Trey Adams lands with the Bills. Hunter Bryant signs with the Lions. Sivan Ahmed with the 49ers. That's actually a really interesting spot if that 40 proves inaccurate and he plays as fast as he did on the field. They traded Matt Breida during the draft, so you know, potentially an opening for him to make that roster.
Great.
Yeah, Miles Bryant goes to the Patriots, and Jared Hilbers to the New York Jets. All right. Well, I guess the other thing we should talk about here, I mean, we've sort of gone over kind of our big picture takeaways from the draft, is how are you feeling right now about the chances of the Seahawks bringing back Jadeveon Clowney? I was feeling pretty negative after the whole comment, you know, post-draft, that, like, the door is not closed to that. Because if you have to say the door is not closed to that, there's a chance you think that other people think the door is closed to that, or that it's reasonable to think that the door is closed to that.
I do not know if they're going to send Clowney. I guess I feel pretty negative on it still, but I really hope they do send Jadeveon Clowney because he's very good at football. And watching him wreck the 49ers was my single most enjoyable moment of the entire season, I think. So I would definitely like to be in a position where I get to watch him do that again to Jimmy Garoppolo. I like the idea of Jimmy Garoppolo having to face him twice in the season. Like, there are a lot of, you know, good things about it. You look at what date are we? We're end of April. What are the reasons that they would make those cuts now? It's basically, I guess, did they just do it because the draft is over? They got the guard they wanted. They feel like they can make those moves. Are they trying to clear up space immediately to make a move here coming up, because they do have some of that? I guess that's the interesting thing to me, especially I think the comp pick deadline is coming up here pretty quick.
It is Monday is the comp pick deadline.
Yeah, afternoon. Is that okay? Perfect. So that, yeah. So I guess if they were trying to sign an external guy, like I guess Everson Griffin, is that who we hope for externally?
But they're not gonna get comp picks at this point. Like, so I'm not sure that's a big concern from their standpoint. It'd be more like, is another team waiting to sign Clowney? Because that
is Tennessee basically waiting to sign him until after the comp pick deadline. And Seattle, like, hypothetically trying to match their offer or something to get up there, now that Tennessee is ready to move on it. I guess that's the most optimistic scenario.
Yeah. So.
Sure hope he signs. I mean, if they were to somehow bring back Clowney, I mean, like, obviously the chatter among people who know nothing about this is basically, if you search through Twitter for Clowney, it's half Seahawks fans confident that the Seahawks are going to sign Clowney tomorrow, and half Titans fans confident that they're going to sign Clowney tomorrow. So it feels like, who knows, maybe there's steam. It's felt like there's been steam at various other times with Clowney through this free agency process. If they bring him back and you look at this pass rushing group, now that they have an elite player in the mix with a lot of basically like B-minus level pass rushers, but a lot of depth when you look at between Bruce Irvin, Collier, the two players they just drafted, Rasheem Green, Shaq Griffin, who had his hand on the ground in the playoff game. Like, there's definitely, like, huge play when the Griffin brothers hit Rodgers in the playoff game.
I think one of the things we've seen is the Seahawks want to make sure that they're not in a position where they are forced to rely on Shaquem Griffin for pass rush ever again.
But still, a lot of pass rushers on this roster. And if they do bring back Clowney, all of a sudden you're looking at it where you're like, this is they have a good chance of being a very good pass rush all of a sudden, especially being a very good pass rush every down, where the drop off from the starters to the backups isn't that great. If there are injuries, they aren't as affected. And it's like, this is the one place where I feel a little bit better about the Seahawks right now if they make a move and bring back one of the best pass rushers in the NFL. But it really is out there available to them.
It is incredible to me that I have so completely memory-holed our first-round pick from 1 year ago that you said the name Collier, and it's like surprised me. Like, it caught me off guard, and I started laughing because, like, it's so absurd to think about LJ Collier being a thing, but like he's an actual first round pick from 1 year ago. And
somehow think Jordan Brooks is a worse pick too.
No, so I didn't say he was a worse pick than Collier, right? Collier's the worst pick ever. That's right.
You said worst
we don't have an audio record of all these things that I said. Right? They just disappear into the ether. I will say actually on that point, I think the Penny pick, you know, in the light of day, having looked back, the Penny pick is worse, especially because they didn't go and draft a running back then in the second round. So but, no, the Brooks pick, I mean, definitely not as bad as the Penny pick, but you do think that the stuff around the Collier pick, if it were not Collier, like it's all the right stuff to do. They just took the wrong guy.
Right. Well, on that note, Zach, thanks so much for helping us work through the draft over the last few weeks here. We look forward to someday again being able to decide a food competition with you. And thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thanks.
It really is like working through stuff around the draft, I feel like.
Oh, for sure.
That is the best Pelton Cast segment I've ever heard.
that you're the only one who ever hears.
I released the tapes, Kevin.
Oh, God.
Oh, I didn't realize what was happening for like the first 30 seconds when I realized that Tristan had just fully not heard it correct and he was going to town on this guy for not speaking clearly enough. That was, thank you for that, Tristan. I needed that.
Anytime, yes.